This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first recorded on the 16th of January 2021. Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. On the show ahead, we'll shuffle through the day's papers and we'll join our editor, Andrew Tuck.
When it's eventually my turn to be vaccinated, I may claim that Hancock has been saying, in the arse, anything to look away and not see the needle.
Then we'll find out about online publishing apps Inkit and Galatea and how they discover hidden talents and turn them into globally successful authors. And finally,
we learned that a Moscow kebab entrepreneur had opened an outlet called Stalin Donner, featuring staff dressed in NKVD uniforms, serving dishes named after the unlamented tyrant and various of his hench people.
Andrew Muller gives us his wry take on the week. All that coming up on Monocle on Saturday. Do stay with us. First, here are the headlines. The worldwide coronavirus death toll surpassed 2 million on Friday, according to a Reuters tally, as nations around the world are trying to procure multiple vaccines and detect new COVID-19 variants. It took 9 months for the world to record the first 1 million deaths from the virus, but only 3 months to go from 1 to 2 million deaths, illustrating an accelerating rate of fatalities. The United States has imposed sanctions on companies in Iran, China and the United Arab Emirates for doing business with the Islamic Republic of Iran's shipping lines and on three Iranian entities over conventional arms proliferation. They're the latest in a series of measures aimed at stepping up pressure on Tehran in the waning days of President Donald Trump's administration, which ends on Wednesday. An aftershock hit Indonesia's Sulawesi Island today as rescue workers search for people trapped under rubble after an earthquake killed at least 45 people, injured hundreds and sent thousands fleeing in terror. And in our pacey weekend edition bulletin this week, we try on the remarkable footwear of both the sitting vice president and of one very fortunate French football team before we hotfoot it to Italy to find out what makes one of its most celebrated newspaper editors tick. And we go toe-to-toe with Karl Lagerfeld's bodyguard. And that's your Monocle 24 news. Well, it's time now to have a browse through this morning's papers, and I'm joined today by Laura Walters, a New Zealand correspondent based here in the UK. Good morning to you, Laura.
Good morning, Georgina.
Now, the British papers are, I'm afraid, very, very gloomy. We're looking at border closures. We're looking at COVID deaths over 2 million worldwide now, pressure on the NHS. It's all a pretty bleak picture, but the Scotsman has a slightly more hopeful take.
Yeah, like you were saying just before in your headlines, surpassing that 2 million deaths marker is really horrific, and rightfully so. So many papers have gone with that this morning. But yeah, like you say, the Scotsman has quite a nice take on the COVID story today. Their front page is more about what we could do to make things better, where we could go from here. And they've gone with the headline, UK vaccine supply can secure early escape from lockdown, which, you know, I think will be on a lot of people's minds at the moment, everyone kind of wanting to escape from lockdown. And this is a story based off some analysis from former PM Tony Blair, who's really getting behind this push for a good vaccine rollout and kind of giving his take and his ideas on what we should be doing now to make sure that this is successful. You know, more of a focus on the single shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine that's looking really good and it's coming through. He's got lots of suggestions about, you know, how we can use GP practices and pharmacies to a greater extent. And so I just thought it was quite a nice hopeful take on what needs to happen from now to make sure that, you know, we move out of this lockdown quickly, we get people vaccinated quickly, rather than kind of reflecting on all of the doom and gloom from the past 10 months and, you know, the crisis that we're we're in at the moment. So I just thought that was a really interesting package from them. And with that headline on the front page, we also had this really gleeful picture of kids, you know, tobogganing in some snow. So it was a far more kind of upbeat and hopeful take on it. But of course, with, you know, a bit of analysis in there and some real specifics on what could be done better. So yeah, a bit different to the rest of the British papers, I thought.
And whatever one thinks of Tony Blair and his patchy record, he is actually stepping up. He feels, and everything he's saying is much more statesmanlike than our elected leaders right now.
Oh, absolutely. It seems like he's pulling the, you know, the politics out of it and really just being quite pragmatic and focused. And you really get that with his analysis. It's not about blaming anyone, not about saying what's gone wrong. It's about, OK, what do we do now and what's best for the country? Because, you know, as he points out, this is a massive crisis. I think he says something like, you know, the worst one in his lifetime. Which is very fair. So, yeah, it is far more statesmanly. Mm.
Let's cross to America now and the Washington Post. And, of course, the ramifications of that mob descending on the Capitol are still being felt.
Oh, absolutely. It's all across the papers, isn't it? And taking up a massive chunk of the front section of each paper is still focusing on that, you know, insurrection or riots or whatever you would, you know, prefer to call it at the Capitol. And, you know, rightfully so, early on, there's a lot of criticism of the lack of preventative measures from police and also the response from some police when that attack on the Capitol happened. So I'm quite interested to see how that coverage is just starting to shift over the past day or so. And it's more, you know, turning towards looking at the bravery and the positive stories that have come out of this. So some of the police that, you know, really stood up to defend the Capitol. And, you know, the Washington Post has gone with this front page of how DC police held their ground. And they've got this, you know, this beautiful picture of a couple of policemen there, you know, just in their plain clothes, not, a stage shot of them in their uniforms. And it talks about, you know, how when they got the call and how they responded and what it was like for them. And there are some beautiful quotes in this Washington Post story. You know, one of them said that it was more like a medieval battle scene when they arrived. And one said when they got the call that, you know, there were people trying to overthrow the seat of the democracy, that, you know, they effing went. So just some really nice coverage there and really paying respect to those cops that did do the right thing and did step up. And of course, we've also had some beautiful headlines and stories recently about the black police officer who might now be awarded a congressional medal, you know, who drew some of those rioters away from the Senate. So. Yeah. Yeah.
So a lovely, hopeful story about police. But here in the Philippines, you've got one on the other side.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry to bombard you with so many cop stories this morning. But this just really caught my eye from the Philippine Inquirer. The front page is four police officers arrested as part of a meth lab sting. So we have these four cops who were protecting the operations of a meth lab. But the really fascinating thing here is, you know, it's quite a short story. It names the police officers, says what they're charged with, but it's packaged up with this massive picture where the police have given this picture to the media to run, but they've warped the officers' faces, which I've never seen before. You know, usually there's no picture and no names if you're trying to protect an identity. Or sometimes, you know, the faces might be blurred or blanked out. But they've used this unusual type of technology to warp the policemen's faces while still naming them in the story. So I just thought that was something I hadn't seen before and quite an interesting decision from police and from media to run that picture really big on the front page.
Yeah, absolutely. Finally, let's look at Joe the Pigeon.
Oh, yeah, I love this story. I mean, sorry, brace yourself. It's not a happy story. But
But I'm going to stop you there and say I know what you're about to say, and it's developed since then. But give us the story as far as it runs in the Washington Post, and then I'll update you.
Oh, fantastic. I'm so glad you've got some good news for me. So he's a racing pigeon who has been called Joe after Joe Biden. He somehow got lost. I think he was in Oregon at some event in October and somehow got off course, might have kind of hitched a ride on a cargo ship, and has made his way all the way to Australia, where, you know, he showed up in someone's backyard in Melbourne, and this man, you know, fed him and got him back to health, and he's made friends with a local dove. And but the story in the Washington Post was saying that he's now facing the death penalty because of Australia's really tough biosecurity laws. So his life was hanging in the balance when I read that story. But tell me you've got some good news, Georgina.
I do. So Australia's Agricultural Department, who, as you say, viewed him as a potential biosecurity risk to the native flora and fauna, now say that Joe is highly likely to be Australian and they have no plans to kill him.
Oh, that's fantastic. A good story if he's just an Aussie pigeon, but I'm glad it's got a happy ending.
Laura, thanks very much indeed. That was Laura Walters. You're listening to Monocle on Saturday. And now, over to Andrew Tuck.
When talking about the COVID vaccine rollout, government officials, including the PM, and especially our health secretary, Matt Hancock, make it oddly clear exactly where the jab has been given. I don't mean geographically as in, say, Thurrock, but rather the spot on the recipient's body. Hancock was at it again this week, telling TV viewers, "The good news is we're managing to get it out into the arms as quickly as the two companies are delivering it to us." Is he signalling that it won't be injected into Britain's prized bottoms? Well, judging by how often he says it, I wonder if a market research group warned him that old folk are nervous of being asked to drop their bloomers for the good cause, and so may refuse to respond to the call-up. Something's afoot, or at least a buttock, because the man cannot stop himself. Although, personally, I'd prefer it in a buttock. The sight of a needle, even on a TV show, makes me feel faint. As a child, I had terrible hay fever, and each spring, in a bid to prevent the annual sneezeathon, I would have to submit to a series of 8 weekly injections of increasing intensity to supposedly give me some resistance. But if my arm swelled, I would have to repeat the dose, which meant that some years I would end up having as many as 15 injections. And by the time summer finally rolled around, I was as perforated as an Airtex vest that's been eaten by moths. It's left me with needle issues. When it's eventually my turn to be vaccinated, I may claim that Hancock has been saying, in the arse, anything to look away and not see the needle. Although the UK vaccine programme is seemingly almost going to plan, and those in the most at-risk groups, some 15 million people, should have all been offered a jab by mid-February. And certainly my senior neighbours and relatives have all had their initial injections. But the odd thing is that, for now, the messaging is that it offers no freedom. Even if you cannot catch it, perhaps you might pass it on, or so they claim. But that's a tricky line of argument. And it's another reason why people just aren't shutting themselves away so strictly in this lockdown. When the young know that their grandparents are probably safe, it changes how they feel too. Meanwhile, I have a feeling that underground raves for the inoculated over 80s could be a growth market. A friend tells me that the builder on their project, a successful Polish entrepreneur, is obsessed with the anti-vaccination story, that the whole thing is a ruse so that Bill Gates can insert a microchip into everyone's arm. The builder says that he will refuse the invite to be vaccinated, as he does not want to be tracked by big tech. He forwards a bonkers video of some doomster's rant from his app-laden smartphone that supplies more data on him than anyone needs, tracks his every move, and knows all about his penchant for pierogi. But apparently, while his logic may be flawed, his plastering is faultless. If you thought that the Brexit debate was over, bad luck. Everything is now filtered through the deal and its consequences. Successful vaccine program? It's because we left the EU. And it certainly seems to be the ambition of Boris and the gang to beat our neighbours in this particular race. This week there was a kerfuffle over whether the hoi polloi could be told how many doses were actually in the UK. The reason? We were scared that other countries might steal our orders. A government spokesman told one newspaper, it's partly a matter of security, but it's also to protect manufacturers from pressure from other countries to deliver more to them once they know how much we're getting. So yes, the vaccine programme is about protecting our health, but it's also geared to burnishing the government's bruised reputation. I did have a jab, though, for flu. As the doctor guided me into his office, he said, I hope you don't mind, I have a trainee with me today who will be giving you the injection. It's hard to make a dash for it at this point. The trainee explained that my arm might hurt afterwards, that I could feel ill for a few days, and that there was a risk of going into anaphylactic shock. I assured him that potential death was really not an issue, but seeing the injection most definitely was. A manoeuvre was agreed where I would look away and he would alert me when it was over. I even got a little plaster. But I really hope that there aren't many people like me around, or it'll never be my turn to get the COVID jab, in my arm or anywhere else.
Many thanks to Andrew Tuck. Now on to another Andrew. Our contributing editor Andrew Muller has been looking back at a very eventful few days.
We learned this week that we might have to be quick. We had already learned, indeed had known for some while, that these are maybe suboptimal times for tempting omens. So when we learned that one of the ravens resident at the Tower of London had been reported missing, we feared that the time might have come, if you like, to begin winching up the drawbridge. Legend insists that if the tower's corvid contingent drops below 6, this kingdom falls. And we learned last year that lockdowns associated with the COVID-19 pandemic were already proving a challenge in this respect. The bored birds were foraging elsewhere. And we've now learned that one, Merlina, appears irrecoverably absent without leave, reducing the population to the precarious half dozen minimum. Don't complain you weren't warned, is what we're saying. We're going to need that agonising gear-grinding sound effect again. Because, sticking with the subject of regimes being threatened by a straining of conventional limits, we learned this week that US President Benito Cartman had become the first occupant of the office to be impeached for a second time.
On this vote, the ayes are 232, the nays are 197. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
We learned that Donald Trump therefore beats the record he previously held jointly with Bill Clinton, who took two terms to get impeached once, and Andrew Johnson, who, though also a single-termer, did at least manage to buy Alaska from Russia and was therefore a more successful real estate impresario than Donald Trump, who couldn't get Denmark to sell him Greenland. Anyway, and this segue, while admittedly unwieldy, is smoother than the previous, sticking with the subject of portly demagogues with weird hair who owe a great deal of their prominence to a bequest from their father. We learned that North Korean leader and cake enthusiast Kim Jong-un has been elected General Secretary of the Workers' Party of Korea in a contest believed to have been the cause of few up-all-night gatherings in Pyongyang pubs to watch the results come in. But turning to Workers' Party newspaper Rodong Sinmun, as we very often do when trying to pad one of these things out, we learned that Kim is not resting on his laurels, which will come as a considerable relief to his laurels. We learned that under Kim's encouragement, labourers at the Sangwon limestone mine have helped generate, along with their workaday commodity, the least enticing headline in the history of journalism, as read now with due ceremony by Monocle's uninspiring agitprop desk chief, Carlotta Ribello.
Cement produced in large amount.
More as we have it, etc. But we also learned, and we're going to need an extremely smooth gear change sound effect here, we feel like we've earned it, something of the frailty of personality cults. We learned that a Moscow kebab entrepreneur had opened an outlet called Stalin Donner, featuring staff dressed in NKVD uniforms, serving dishes named after the unlamented tyrant and various of his henchpeople. With swiftness and ruthlessness that might have impressed Stalin Donner's namesake, the establishment was denounced by neighbours and closed by police, though the ironic echo of history appears to have stopped short of deporting the proprietor to the Siberian salt pile. And along not altogether dissimilar lines, thematically and geographically, we learned that one needs to tread extremely carefully indeed when deploying the swastika in order to make some sort of allegorical point, and that indeed in general one is probably just best off not doing it. Actually, just to be clear, we, which is to say the compilers, producers and narrators of this monologue, had already pretty much gotten our heads around this one, and we assume that most of our listeners have as well. Let's have the general muttered agreement file again. We learned, however, that the choreographers of the Udmurtia State Circus, beloved attraction of the Russian Republic of Udmurt, have not. An amount of bewilderment was generated by a performance in, we'll turn this over to our Russian pronunciations desk chief, Paige Reynolds.
Izhevsk. Izhevsk.
Anyway, the performance in, what Paige said, featured a monkey wearing a Nazi uniform and goats draped in swastikas. The circus's head of PR, and you think you're having a bad day, hastened to explain that viral photo images had been taken out of context. We learned that the whole thing had been a metaphor for the Soviet Union's defeat of fascism, hence the Red Army kit sported by the handlers. So we learned, to our considerable disappointment, that the Udmurtia State Circus was not going to hit back at the protests by grumbling that its political correctness gone mad, you can't even dress goats as Nazis these days, and inveighing indignantly against the nanny state. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you to Andrew. Listening to Monocle on Saturday, I'm Georgina Godwin, and now it's time to meet Lauren Burns, co-founder of Galatea and acting creative content director at Inkit, a voracious reader and published author who's been writing on online platforms since she was 14 years old. Lauren was born in Canada and now lives in Berlin, working with her cousin Emma Tonner at Inkit. In 2018, Lauren co-founded Galatea, the world's first immersive reading app, with Emma, and hasn't looked back. Welcome to the show, Lauren.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Can you tell us, what are Inkit and Galatea and how do they work?
Absolutely. So the main idea behind Inkit and Galatea is to use technology to systematically discover the most talented novelists in the world and turn their stories into successful blockbusters. And the how behind all of this is that Inkit is an online platform where novelists can upload their manuscripts and then readers can read these stories for free initially. In the background behind all of this, we analyze the engagement of the readers while they read each story and measure how much they like each one. We then offer a publishing deal to the top performing stories based off of the data points that we collect. And then these top stories are published on Galatea. Galatea is an immersive reading experience, as you mentioned. So we take these fantastic stories and then add in different elements like chat fiction, sound effects, vibrations to bring the whole stories to life.
Oh, it sounds absolutely wonderful. Tell us about some of your successful authors and best stories.
Yeah, it would be a pleasure. I have the wonderful opportunity to work with a whole bunch of fantastic, successful authors that we discovered using this platform. One of our authors is S.S. Sahu, and she wrote a story called The Arrangement. She lives in Odisha, India, where there is only a 64% literacy rate for women. And she actually wrote the entire original manuscript on her phone and is now making millions of dollars in sales through the international audience that we access on Galatea. We have another author, Sapir Englert, who's 25 years old and comes from Israel originally. She just crossed the $5 million in sales mark this past year and is able to use her royalties to go to Boston's Berklee College of Music.
This sounds really, this is such a wonderful, innovative idea, and of course gives people from all parts of the world an opportunity. I mean, it's really opening up publishing, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And as I said, it's absolutely thrilling to me that we're able to work with all of these authors and are able to use the technology we have to systematize and also make the entire publishing process more objective for authors like Sapir and Simran.
So how then do you make a Galatea story?
Well, we acquire all of these wonderful stories from the authors, and then we publish them on Galatea, like I said, but they aren't just text. We add in all of these immersive elements. And to do this, we work with a fantastic team of in-house writers, many of whom come from Hollywood and screenwriting backgrounds, as well as a team of sound designers to create the immersive format that you see on Galatea.
How do you think that lockdowns impacted people's reading habits, and has it had an effect on your company?
It's been a very tough year for people, I think, everywhere. But we are very fortunate in a sense because we're able to offer all of the readers on our platform and all of the writers on our platform a sort of alternate fictional universe they can escape into when they're struggling or just if they're at home looking for something to do. So in fact, we've seen our readership and writer activity double since the first lockdown started.
I mean, this is clearly the future of publishing, don't you think?
I really like to think so. I mean, we are able to change the whole publishing process to make sure that it's more objective and that we can use systematic testing and systematic data collection in order to maintain and keep up the reading experience. So,
Lauren, thank you very much indeed. That was Lauren Burns of Inkit and Galatea. And that's all for today's programme, which was produced by Marcus Hippie and our studio engineer was Nora Hull. I'm Georgina Godwin, and Monocle on Saturday will return next week.